Well, good morning, everybody. Let's be honest. How many of you started out for the first service and realized you were an hour late and you came to the second service? Anybody? Good job. Good job. You know, we have a little special guy with us today. There's a gentleman, well, I think he's here this morning, that got a special award at school. This young man won the Dale Lackey Award. It's a scholarship based on outstanding athletic performance, character, community service, and academic success in their 4 years of high school. For a Pioneer Valley League, it was Sam Davis. Is he here this morning? No? I thought he was here. Is he here? I didn't see him here. Oh, there he is. Stand up, Sam. Just stand up and say, there he is right there. Good job, Sam. Being a Placer Hillman graduate, I'm surprised anything good came out of Bear River, but, you know, we can let that go, right? Hey, guys, men's softball starting in a couple weeks. If you like to play softball, we play on Thursday nights. You're welcome to come join our team. We are in the lowest league possible, so come on out and join us. We'll be having some practices, you know, on your response form. You can let us know if you'd like to join the team. We'll get in touch with you. Guys that normally play with us, you'll get an email when we're ready to start, but that's coming up pretty soon. Also, you know, we're having our national conference here this year. You know, our fellowship in North America has an annual conference once a year, and this year they've asked us to host it. And this week we posted 17 of your homes that you're opening up for people that are coming. So thank you so much for that. That's just wonderful. You know, that's, people are coming a long ways, these church pastors and staffs, and opening up your homes is a great way to do that. Someone did say thank you. I know on the stage this morning there were some opportunities presented to you to get involved in some things, to partner with some things. I just want you to know money will never be the face of Auburn Grace. I don't mind presenting opportunities to you, and we vetted them to make sure that if you give to them or you partner with them, those are really good people and projects. Don't feel like you have to give to all of them or any of them. That's up to you. It's up to how the Lord is leading you. So I don't mind presenting things to you. Certainly Ruthie and I don't support everything that's on the stage. There's no way we could, and we're not expecting any of you to do that the same. But there are a lot of great things going on, and so we want to present those to you, and you do them as the Lord leads. All right? So we're in 1 Corinthians today. We're going to skip from chapter 7, which we finished, to chapter 8, and we're moving into a whole new phase of the book. So I changed the name from Messy Faith to Growing Faith. I know on the front of your bulletin says Messy Faith, but I got the PowerPoint done after that was printed, so I went ahead and changed it for my slides. Growing Faith, Practical Solutions for Life. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 this morning. Chapter 7. We just finished chapter 6. Let me ask you a question. How many of you here this morning are first-generation Christians, which means your parents didn't raise you as a Christian, they weren't followers of Jesus, but you became the first generation of followers of Jesus in your family? Raise your hand. Well, look around. There's a lot of you, okay? There's a lot of you. Good job. That's a hard thing to do, isn't it? Now, how many of you are second-generation Christians, where your parents were first-generation? That was me. I grew up as a second-generation Christian. And, you know, first-generation Christians have some tendencies. And one of the tendencies that first-generation Christians have is to take their newfound faith a little bit to an extreme. My parents, wow, they were extreme, right? They had so many rules. No, but first-generation Christians get so on fire, and they want to set aside their old life so much that if they're not careful, they can take it to an extreme and move into, like, legalistic faith. And in 1 Corinthians, what we're finding is that the folks that were in Corinth were all first-generation Christians. None of them had grown up with Jesus in their home. So now as adults, they had become followers of Jesus. They'd been in this Corinthian culture, which was affluent, multiracial, multicultural, interfaith. And all of a sudden, they found this incredible person named Jesus. And they're giving their all to him, but they're first-generation Christians. And so as they try to work out their faith, they have questions. How many of you came to follow Jesus seriously after you were 20 years old? Okay, look around. So you had to overcome some things. How many of you started following Jesus seriously after 30 years old? That's my father. Okay? And the older you are, when you really seriously start following Jesus, the more you have to overcome and the more you got to think through, because the more adjustments there are. And so what was happening in Corinth is they were getting together for church every week, and there were multiple races in there, multiple ethnicities. There was affluence, there was poor, there were slave people, there were men, there were women, there were people from all over the world. And all of them were first generation Christians, mostly all adults that trying to overcome stuff from their past, and they have questions. So they get together as a little congregation, and they put together a list of questions, and they get a couple of people, and they give them some money, and they say, hey, will you go find Paul in Ephesus, and will you have him answer our questions about how to live life with Jesus? And so chapter 7 through chapter 14 are Paul's letter back to them, answering these series of questions about how to live life with Jesus. They're first generation Christians, and they're not sure how to do it. And they have a tendency to become a little bit radical. Now, we saw in chapter 6 that some of the folks in Corinth were really holding on to this idea that was prevalent in the ancient world, this idea that we term in theology called Gnosticism. Everybody say Gnosticism. Gnosticism means I separate my physical life from my spiritual life. And God doesn't care what I do in my physical life. All he cares about is my spiritual life. And Paul spent chapter 6 trying to say, no, asceticism isn't right. When you gave Jesus your life, you gave him all, and he wants you to glorify God in your body. Well, the other end of the pendulum from Gnosticism is this idea that we call asceticism. Say asceticism. Asceticism is the idea that I want to be 1,000% committed to God, and I am going to forsake everything in the physical world. I'm not going to wear makeup. I'm not going to do my hair. I'm going to dress very simply. I'm even going to forsake relationships for the sake of my devotion to God. Throughout history, we've seen movements like monks who leave everything, and they go to a deserted place, and they live in a monastery where they can just read their Bibles and pray and study, and they forsake everything else in life because they just want to be 1,000% pure and committed to Jesus. And that's a good idea, but taken to an extreme leads to legalism. And unfortunately, some of the folks in Corinth had swung the pendulum as first-generation Christians that far. And especially when it comes to marriage and family. It's interesting, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, let's look at the first topic that Paul is going to respond to. And it says in verse 1, now concerning the things about which you wrote. So here's one of them. It is good for a man to not touch a what? I mean, a who, I'm sorry. Women aren't what, a who. Now, we don't know if this is Paul's summary of their question, because maybe their question concluded, Paul, we think it's not good to have any kind of relationships, especially physical intimacy relationships, because we just want to be pure. And that kind of stuff is not, is it pure? Or is this statement the summary of Paul's answer? Paul's going to conclude, you know what? It's better to stay single than it is to get married. But whichever one, Paul is going to answer the question about physical relationships, specifically marriage and family. When it comes to my devotion to God, where does my marriage and where do my family fit in? Now, in order to understand this better, we've got to go back to the first century and talk about what kind of marriages there were. Because in the church, there were people from all different kinds of marriages. You know, slaves were very prevalent in the Roman Empire, and there were slaves that had become followers of Jesus that were now sitting in church. And slaves weren't allowed to be married in the Roman Empire. Now, slaves were allowed to move in together, and they would be called, in a sense, married. It was called your tent companionship. If a slave owner gave permission for one of his slaves to move into a tent with someone else's slave because the two slaves had fallen in love, they would give permission and they would move in together and kind of be married, although there was no ceremony, and they would be called tent companions. But both of them knew at any moment the masters could sell them to someone else and rip that relationship apart and send them away. So that tent companionship relationship was very volatile in the sense that it could end at any moment. But they were considered married. So there were some people sitting in the Corinthian church that were slaves that had come to Jesus. And Paul is trying to talk about the importance of marriage, and they're wondering, well, am I really married? And as a tent companionship, does that honor God? What if this is my second or third one because my former tent companions have been sold to someone else in distant lands? Should I stay married to this person? Should I send them away? I want to be devoted to Jesus, so what should I do with my tent companion? The second kind of marriage was the common law marriage like we have today. But in the Roman Empire, you only had to stay together 1 year and then you were considered married. So their common law marriage was 1 year together, you're considered married. But now I want to follow Jesus. I wasn't actually really married. We just lived together for a year and became common law partners. So does God see that as pure? Should I divorce him? Should I marry him? What should I do, Paul? What should I do? The third kind of marriage is where dads could sell their daughters into marriage by requiring a dowry. And so that marriage wasn't really based on two young people falling in love with each other. It was based on who could give the biggest gift to dad. I kind of like this particular model. In fact, I tried it with our daughter. We have one daughter. When I took her to Kenya on a mission trip one time, I was offered 30 cows for her, and it was pretty tempting. She was in high school at the time, and I thought, wow, I could be like a cattle baron here. She loved Kenya so much, she went back after one of her years of college to do a six-week internship, and she's much more married-ready then. I thought, I'm going to get an offer for like 100 cows. She didn't want to do that. She came home and finished her nursing degree and moved to Anchorage, Alaska, and met some guy named Joe who didn't give me a dime to marry her. In fact, I had to pay thousands of dollars to get him to come to Grass Valley to say yes in front of a bunch of people. I could have been a cattle baron. Instead, I got Joe. You know, I got Joe. Actually, we love Joe. He's awesome. We love Joe. But that was the third way. So you have people sitting in church that are married, but it was kind of arranged. And now they want to follow Jesus. What should they do? The fourth kind of marriage was the classical Roman marriage. If you had enough money, you would do your marriage ceremony much like we do it today. You get the families together on a specific day. You have this big celebration. You share vows with each other. You share rings. In fact, the Romans, one of the ancient Roman doctors thought he discovered a nerve that went from the third fingertip of the hand directly to the heart. And so that's why they started putting rings on the third finger. And then after the ceremony, they would have cake. Isn't it interesting that that's almost exactly how we do it in our culture today? And although our country was founded on Judeo-Christian ethics, we follow more the Roman model of marriage ceremony than the Jewish model of the marriage ceremony. So anyhow, you could be married in a classical way. So in church on Sunday, here's all these first generation Christians trying to be 1,000% devoted to God, and they think maybe what I need to do to follow God is I've got to shed all these relationships. So Paul, what do you think? Is it better for a man not to touch a woman? That's kind of our conclusion. Paul, what do you think? Paul, what do you think? So the first seven verses are the beginning of Paul's response to this question. Folks sitting in church, Their hearts are devoted to God. What should I shed in my devotion to him? And what we're going to find in this chapter is a simple word called balance, right? The pendulum swinging all the way over here to Gnosticism. That's an extreme. That's not God's plan. And a pendulum swinging all the way to this side to asceticism and legalism in marriage and in family. That's not what God wants. But don't you often find that what God really wants for us is balance right in the middle, right? God is a balanced God. And so he's going to begin to talk to them about how marriage works within our devotion to Jesus. You ready? Here's a couple of principles we're going to look at this morning. I'm going to spend a couple of weeks unpackaging chapter 7 for us. The first thing that we notice is there in verse 1, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Verse 2, but because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. He goes out the gate in verse 1 and says, maybe it is better for a man not to touch a woman. Maybe singleness is an option. And he's going to tell us in this chapter that singleness is a solid option. The problem is most people can't handle it. Because in verse 2, he says, but because of what? Immoralities. In other words, there's temptations out there. And living a single life constantly being bombarded with sexual temptation, it's not going to be long that I'm going to compromise. And so he says there, part of the reason that we get married is to thwart off our immorality. There's so many temptations for single people that unless it's a gift from God, his advice is don't stay single. Because there's too many temptations. And a life filled with temptations and compromising into those temptations leads to the kind of life that you can't have being fully devoted to God. So he says there, each man should have a wife and each woman should have a husband, which also tells us that these temptations towards sexual impurity are not just a guy thing. All the guys say amen. It's what ladies struggle with as well. It's what wives and husbands struggle with. He doesn't just say, men, get a wife. He also says, ladies, get a husband. If living a single life is just too temptuous for us, then it's awesome to get married. And part of the marriage relationship is helping your spouse keep pure before God by not falling into immorality. Let's keep going. Marriage is a preventative to immoralities. It is good, he says. Being single has its advantages. And certainly in Paul's day, it would have been hard to be a Christian and single. If you were here the last couple of weeks as we talked about all the temptations in Corinth, it would have been a very difficult to be a Christian single person in Corinth with all the temptations that were there, not unlike our culture today. So yes, it is good, he says, if you can remain single. It has its advantages. But verse 2 tells us that one of the ways that we thwart or prevent immorality is by getting married. Verse 3 says, the husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Healthy marriages help avert harmful behavior. Again, what we're trying to do in marriage is help our spouse be as devoted to Jesus as possible. And one of the ways I help them be, or help her, or I help, or you help him be devoted to Jesus is not letting him fight all the temptations of immorality that are all around her. So I'm going to give my body to my wife. You're going to give your body, wives, to your husbands, not because he's going to demand it. This verse is not not permission from one partner to demand the body of the other partner. This verse is all about, hey, do you realize that when you got married, the bodies were part of the gift? And part of that gift was to help them to stay pure in their walk with God by not letting them be tempted beyond what they are able and stumble and fall. So marriage is actually a beautiful assistance to someone, to all of us who struggle with temptation in this culture, as in Paul's culture. Verse 5, stop what? Depriving. You know, they were depriving each other, and here's why. Because in the Roman culture, when you got married, it usually really wasn't for love. I mean, the husbands didn't really look at their wives as their lovers. Wives were expected to be the counterpart for the husband in the home. They were to help raise the kids and to keep the home and to be by his side when he went to business gatherings. It was a mutual beneficial relationship, but in the Roman Empire, husbands didn't typically look at their wives as their lovers. If they wanted to have some fun, they would go to the temple of Aphrodite, or they would have a concubine. They didn't really view that as part of the relationship. And you know what? The women didn't either. There's a lot in history. There's a book called The Daily Life of the Romans. And in it, the historian talks about how the women didn't really look at their husbands as their lovers. Their husbands were more their protectors in society, because a single woman living in Rome on her own was very vulnerable. And so you married for your protection, and you married for your provision, and you married so that you could be a mom. But you didn't really look at your husband as your lover. If you wanted some affection, you would find it in other ways and with other people. And so marriage in Rome was a disaster when it came to loving relationships. And so Paul is trying to instruct them, no. The beauty of the marital relationship is the lovers that you become together. And when you deprive, that's the word there, you deprive that part of the relationship from your spouse, even if you're doing it for the right reason, to be godly people, you are setting them up to face temptations that they're going to compromise in. And you're actually pushing them toward immorality. So Paul says, man, don't deprive each other of this. The sex drive, once that door is opened, is not meant to be shut. And it's not meant to be shared except with that special wife or that special husband. And when we deprive it of each other, Paul says, you are pushing that person toward immorality. And history tells us that in the Roman Empire, both the men and the women were very fiercely independent. That each of them, the man was the man of the house. He was the one that was pushing to get prestige and honor in the community. And he looked at his wife as helping him get that prestige and that honor. And he would have her raise the kids. But as far as affection and devotion, there wasn't much there. And the women, we're told in history, the women of Rome, many of them were mighty, and they were strong, and they were masculine, some of them. And they just were fiercely independent, and they didn't want to look at their husbands as their lovers. They wanted control over their body. This is my body. I will do with it what I want and with whom I want. Boy, does that sound familiar today? And Paul says, when you do that, in your marriage, it actually pushes your spouse toward the temptations of the culture to fall into immorality. And God has designed, when Adam and Eve came together, they looked at each other and they said, this is going to be one rock star night with each other. Right? So verse 5, stop depriving one another. So marital abstinence should be planned out. Let's see verse 5. Stop depriving one another except by what? Agreement for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer and then come again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So what is he saying? He's saying, you know what? If you want to take some time in your life to just totally be focused on God and you're going to fast from other things, fasting and prayer is one of the spiritual practices that Christians do. And prayer and fasting refocuses my heart to be completely God's. And it's perfectly okay for me to say, you know what? I'm going to fast from certain foods. I'm going to fast from certain activities. And I'm going to even fast from intimacy because I want to be 100% focused on God. That's a good thing. But look at the parameters that he puts down here. Number one, it's got to be by agreement. So if the wife can say to the husband, I just want to take some time and dedicate myself wholly and purely to the Lord, so I'm going to take the next 3 years and be abstinent. It's not going to happen. Maybe 3 days, 3 hours. The second one is, it says, in agreement for a time. There needs to be a set time. That you're going to say, you know what? I'm going to devote myself 100% for the next couple of days to the Lord. And I'm just going to take all of my time to do that. I'm going to try and go through my thoughts, my attitudes, my actions. I'm going to purify myself so that I can be closer to God. Have you ever done that kind of activity? If you haven't, a great read is to just read about prayer and fasting and purity. Because throughout the history of our faith, people have regularly practiced taking a designated time that they're going to fast, which means I'm not going to do something, and while I normally would have done that, I'm going to spend time with the Lord. Normally it's food, so that when I feel hunger pains, it reminds me to pray instead of eat. And I can go through a season of purification. I'm refocusing my heart, refocusing my mind. So what they wanted to do was a good thing. But they were just taking it to an extreme and saying, we're going to live this way for the rest of our lives. So he says it's got to be by agreement, and it's got to be for a time, and it's got to be for spiritual growth. He says there's so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. That's a good reason to do this for a while. And then he wraps it up and it says in verse 5, and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Here's what it needs to be agreed upon. It needs to be an exact time set and an immediate reunion. Man, that reunion needs to be like a conjugal visit at Folsom Prison. It's just got to be something that you're going to come together again. Why? Because we're human and there's temptations out there. And once you open that door, that part of your life, it's not meant to be closed. And to close it off for long periods of time just leads to temptations. And before you know it, I can't help myself. I'm going to go up the hill to the temple of Aphrodite. And I don't want to go there. And my spouse and our intimate relationship is what actually helps me not go there. So I can focus on living a great life for Jesus. So asceticism, in a sense, is good. The idea is good. I'm going to neglect some things on this earth to refocus and go deeper in my relationship with God. The problem in Corinth is they were taking it to an extreme and they were trying to make it a permanent part of their life. And Paul says, that's okay if you're single, but that's not part of the marital plan. And then he wraps it up in verse 6 and verse 7. And he says, "But this I say by way of concession, not of command." He says in verse 7, "Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself." You know, it's interesting. We're going to see a couple of times in this chapter where Paul makes his opinions known, not necessarily a command of God. That's an interesting thought, that he has kind of an inspired opinion. There's going to be times when Paul says, "Okay, I'm going to tell you something, and it's not coming from me. It's coming from the Lord." And then there are going to be times when Paul says something, he says, "Now, this is not a command that I receive from the Lord. This is my divine opinion, and I think I have the heart of the Lord." And here's the first one. He says, "I say this by way of concession, not of command." In other words, verse 7, "I wish that all of you were even as myself am." I myself am. We know that Paul was single at this time. We know that Paul, according to Philippians chapter 3, was part of the Pharisaical sect, and he was a part of the Sanhedrin. In order to be part of that group, you had to be married. So we know that at some point in Paul's life, he was married, and now he's single again. We don't know exactly why. History doesn't tell us anything about his wife. And Paul wraps up where he began in verse 1, that he says, "You know what, being single is my preferred position." And he's going to lay out some reasons why in the rest of chapter 7. But he says, "But I'm not commanding people to be single. And I'm not commanding people to be married." Look what he says at the end of verse 7. He says, "Each man or woman has his own gift from who? From God. Whether one in this manner and another at that." So what is Paul saying? Both being single and being married are gifts from God. If you're single here this morning or single again here this morning, you are not in a lower relational position than those that are married. In fact, from what he shared with us today, if you have the gift of singleness, which means you can handle being single without giving into the temptations of life, you're better than those of us that are married. Because one of the reasons we got married was because we can't handle the temptations of the culture. So Paul is giving some very clear instructions here. Their idea was good, but it was taken too far. And Paul is trying to bring it back to the middle. And so he tells them, no, don't neglect your marital relationships just because you're being devoted to Jesus. Don't be devoted. Don't neglect your devotion to your children just because you want to follow Jesus. That's not God's path for you. Now, next week, what we're going to find next week are two very interesting questions. Number one, how do I know whether I have the gift of singleness or not? What's the test? And then second of all, what if I live in a spiritually divided marriage? Because certainly people in Corinth were coming to Jesus, but that tent companion wasn't following Jesus, or that common law partner wasn't following Jesus, or that arranged marital partner wasn't following Jesus, or my wife or husband that we got married in the classical way. What do you do when you want to follow Jesus and your spouse doesn't? And how does that impact the kids? And how do I know whether I have the gift of singleness from God or I don't? These are the questions he's going to answer next week in the next section of chapter 7. But for today, help us to remember that part of the purpose of us being married is to help your partner not compromise in the temptations of the culture. And we do that by loving them. And we do that by willingly giving our bodies to our partners in a loving and kind way so that they can be free from the temptations of the culture. That idea does not stop me from living purely and 100% in love with Jesus. Does that make sense? My marriage is not keeping me from that. And that was their question. All right, so that's where we're going in the next couple of weeks. Let's stand together and pray. Lord, I pray for those that are single in our audience this morning, single here. I pray for those that are single again, like Paul was. Lord, help them to know that they are not in a secondary position in culture. Lord, that they are right where you want them to be. Lord, I pray that they would stay strong in the midst of the cultural temptations that are out there, because they're everywhere. Help them to stay pure. Help them to know whether this is a temporary or a permanent condition of their life. Help them to know whether this is a gift from you or whether you're going to bring them someone someday. And Lord, I pray for those of us that are married. I pray that within the marital relationship, we can find satisfaction and joy in this area. It's such a touchy area. And there's so many emotions, and there are so many mindsets. And in the busyness of life, there's so much tiredness that sometimes it's easy to neglect the needs and the desires of our marital partners. So, Lord, help us to not be independent, but help us to be willing to help our partners succeed in following you by not pushing them toward temptations of the culture. Thank you for this study today. Thank you how Paul once again brings balance to life. That living in the extreme of Gnosticism is not your plan. Living in the extreme of asceticism is not your plan either. Thank you that you bring balance to life. May we live a balanced, passionate Christian life. Thank you for this time together this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks so much for coming. Have a great day today.